So Marshall could be generous on a local level, you know, protest the Spadina Expressway, and yet go into CBC studio and make fun of Patrick Watson and those guys and the whole corporate image that CBC was presenting, and then go and get the Order of Canada. It's incredible the levels that McClure was able to live, but that it indicated the complex multi-audiences that the different media were creating in the global theater, that you could be quadriphenic. You couldn't be quiet. You were forced to become a limited, fragmented role player with some slant back in the Vortices day.
Yeah, no, I'm hearing you. But I'm just going to say, let's come right back to we're back in 1953 with this letter, Bob. And it's okay. And I think what we were just looking at is Pound and McLuhan debating, you know, what is the center of English culture at that point.
And Pound is thinking politically in 19th century bureaucracy.
Yep.
Exactly what LaRouche lays out, that the concept, the more platonic the concept, the proper way of educating people is to have them rehearse all the discoveries that were made rather than having new information crammed down and memorized. So that platonic way of education, LaRouche was for, but that was the world of coming up with the correct concepts, and that would evoke genius in the citizens. You know, it's conceptual massage of the people. And McLuhan is on a whole other level on the new massage level of perceptual environments. So the impulse of LaRouche and Pound is forlorn and very limited. And this is all obvious now to a 20-year-old today.
Yeah, I do like this statement here that where Pound says, and men who really who know really some detail are kept from meeting and intercommunication, which obstructs, causes time lag, which gives the crooks time to operate unhindered. But I guess what he's not seeing is he's saying that the crooks are operating in the interval, which is I mean that is, I guess, the share of overlap with McLuhan, because McLuhan's looking at the crooks as the same thing as well, that they're operating in that tactile interval, but Pound maybe doesn't realize the full extent of what he's saying.
Pound doesn't know that money has become public property in the 30s, that the oligarchs who control money when it was privately owned are obsolesced by radio and the crash of 29-30. So the crooks are not the oligarchs. The crooks are the hustlers selling Elvis Presley or pop culture or ripping off the black culture. The entertainment crooks is the real issue. And there are books on how the mafia controlled the radio and entertainment scene. He's still a POB, still lost back looking at newspaper landscapes and trying to have the correct editorial on that. He's missing the bottom-up level of crooks rising. So we could go on and on about this. I mean, I had another thought there. Pound, it'll come back. But Pound is, and this is what the Ron Paul, and I don't know if you have that kind of sentiment in New Zealand, but you see it in the far right in Europe. These are people trying to maintain human scale for the chemical body and have no clue about the discarnate effect, and then how the discarnate effect was broken up by virtual technology. And that actually retrieved the massive media environments to small people scale. The media became smaller than the small people. So you look at this, are kept. The real men who know, now see, McLuhan was trying to gather the real men who know, are kept from meeting and intercommunication. Yes, that's probably got that from McLuhan, or McLuhan got that. That's something they can understand. They were isolated on the margin. But McLuhan accepted being on the margin. He said, I'll create a distraction. And he almost knew the media would start to be forced to televise his abstraction and be a temporary figure in the E equals MC squared world of instant television. So he says, which causes time. So forget the obstruct. There, time lag. There's no time under V conditions, which gives the crooks time to operate under. It is true that day traders and stealing of money can happen once you get the digital environment, and that happens in the 80s and 90s. But that's not, the bigger crooks are television itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know, he talks about the, you know, the hidden horse, the Trojan horse is the television environment is upsetting all the values that, that, oh, I remember now. But anyways, upsetting all the values that Pound thinks he's for.
Yeah, he's talking about the television as a minotaur that literally eats children.
Yeah, and Pound doesn't see that. He says there are human beings who eat children, you know, the oligarchs. But here's the point. McLuhan says in the 70s that he is nostalgic for the time when there were big egos.
Yeah.
So sentimentally, he loves Pound and those guys and what they represent. And he falls back into that when he bleats at the at Women's Lib and all that stuff. But he recognizes that kind of ego is gone. The ground for that is gone. But he sentimentally enjoys that. That that level of anti-environmental ego that the Bordases had. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, completely.
Yeah. I mean, he admits it in a relaxed moment, you know, talking to June Calvert or something. Well, I miss the big, you know, the big ego. When the days when you could have a big ego.
Yeah, I miss humans, Bob, before the machine crawled into our stomach. Well, I miss them.
But then he'd say, but that's not relevant now. Let's start studying the effects. There are no humans, but what's left over can study the effects.
Yeah.
Understanding. We can escape through understanding.
The thing that I'm really struck with every time I look at the Pound McLuhan dialogue is that McLuhan has gone post-human in 1951. He's forget Catherine Hales, forget all that other nonsense. He spells it out in 51.
He does it in 45. Now, here's my proof of the ego thing. In my first MUM symposium, I quote the Southern Quality essay. On the first page, he's looking at the effects of the bomb, and he says the biggest threat will be to artistic egos. That's right there on the first page.
Yeah.
And he says all these causes are ridiculous and forlorn now because we've gone post-human. In that 1951 letter to Pound, June 22nd, he says total fusion of man and machine, right? So we're going cyborg. But he started to intuit that in 1945-46.
Yeah, well, as soon as the bomb hit, yeah.
Yeah. He had the guts to go through the vanishing point that the bomb implied.
Yeah, I think that's difficult to reconstruct, if not impossible, of what seeing that would have actually done.
Well,
for a younger person, in a certain sense, you know, it's like, well, at least for my generation. I'm a 70s kid, you know, I've never seen what the world was like before satellite, all these other things. And so to retrace and get a sense of what apprehending that atomic bomb would have been for the first time, it's hard.
Well, have you read the quotes by Robert Oppenheimer, guys who were there when they blew it up on July 16th, 1945? They were terrified of what they saw.
Yes, yes, but like again, in print, you don't get that. There's just you get a real sense.
You know why you can't get it? As McLuhan said, and we have it, and Dave Neufeld has it on the Medium as a Massage album that he did and Nelson Thal put out. He quotes McLuhan saying the TV is way more devastating than the bomb.
It's this puny little bomb, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can't go back. It was traumatic for the little people of the Lilliputians of that day, even the genius Lilliputians, but the devastation that implied is nowhere near the devastation you got to go through with television and computers. So you can't feel the small pinches. But back then, McLuhan was on board, you know, taking it up. And what was the thought I had? That he's looking at the artistic ego. He's recognizing this is one thread. That's why he dropped the identification with the Southern passionate features in the 1560s. He said, being Southern doesn't even save you now. You know, it's even more devastating with the TV bomb. You know, so he had to come up with new metaphors. And the one of the greatest paragraphs I ever wrote is the end of War and Peace and Global Village. I think Eric likes to quote it. He knows it. Where McLuhan talks about the media become the new animals and humans become microorganismic.
Yep, yep.
Inbreeders, and the media become the outbreeders. So, you know, that's pretty, that's beyond any science fiction scenario. What's his name? Says we're an insect. Franz Kafka, you know, Metamorphosis, says the guy becomes an insect.
Yep.
Well, no, man, we become microorganismic and subatomic. And he says the new subatomic super civilized man in 1955. You have to see that every science fiction scenario that's turned into an extended novel was in the big picture, in the big patterns, covered already by McLuhan.
Yeah, I was actually going to talk to you about Philip K. Dick, but I'll Valis actually, but I'll do that at another time.
Okay, so what is it about? So here's McLuhan seeing immediately adapting. Oh yeah, the Southern. Passion and fatal dimension, like fatal. Okay, we're all going to get wiped out. That fatality that the bomb implied, he sees as a Southern quality. So he says, well, let's get used to being like that, because that's the environment, that's the emotional response you're going to get in people. So the Southern have already learned to live with that for 200 years. And then he says in Counterblast 969 that the bomb as environment was short-lived. Ever wonder about that? How could the atomic bomb become short-lived? This is what de Kirchhoff missed when he went into the nuclear disarmament thing in 84, when he started, he got a New York Times editorial, and the peace movement was big, the nuclear anti-disarmament thing. De Kirchhoff tried to use McLuhan in a puny way and got lost in that world. But he did try to be McLuhanist by saying the bomb was a service. But the bomb wasn't an environment anymore in 84. What was the new environment? Television. And it was even more lethal than the bomb itself. But, you know, rearview mirror, the bomb becomes a specter of destruction for science fiction and entertainment for the next 25 years. And for television shows, you know, the red meat left by the burglar television to distract the watchdog of the mind. So who are the crooks? Who's the burglar here?
Yeah.
Look at this. The aim of law, visual space, is to prevent coercion either by force or by fraud. It does not. Law does not prevent coercion by subtle invincibles. If invincible... are invincible. Invisibles, if invincible, are in... No. Invisibles, if vicinal, are invincible. The line from Finning is Wake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're missing the erosion of law by technological extensions. He didn't get that. McLuhan, get on with the job. Right when it's time for role-playing. If he had said, get on with the role, McLuhan might have done a double take and deign to go back, condescend, go back and update Pound. But he gave up on Pound.
Yeah.
You have to see how McLuhan grabbed the torch. You know,
yeah, no, it could have been get on with the Job, in which case McLuhan did a good job. He went straight on and did Job from start to finish.
I was talking about that on the Mom session today. How McLuhan says in 68 that pain becomes discovered as a new probe. And he's talking about that Catholic priest who goes into Africa to hang out with the lepers.
Yeah.
Anyways, pain is a probe. That's why in the last known interview we have of McLuhan being interviewed by some anonymous guy, Nelson got it from someplace. McLuhan is, it's like in California, Las Vegas, someplace. And this guy's interested in the oil crisis and Kissinger. McLuhan talks about Kissinger as the kiss of death. But he says, he goes on about the romantic atmosphere. He says, I'm an expert in romanticism. And then he goes on about how I'm not concerned about happiness. I'm here for suffering. I prefer to suffer. Now, you're talking about your Job thing. I'm here to suffer. Not to be happy. And the suffering is pain as a probe. It's an anti-environment to the drugged out state that people were getting in through the soma of electric media. Soma from Brave New World. So now Croker says America is Job, J-O-B, the biblical figure. He does in one of those books. not what's that one data trash and the speed mosaic. Forget the one. There's the possessed individual, and then after that is the data trash. What?
Oh, I was just checking my book. Was it the last six? Or
spasm. Spasm.
Okay.
He does a section at the end of Spasm on the American culture as the culture of Job. But just taking, I don't know, it's like McLuhan said, people putting their hand in the buzzsaw of technology and enjoying it. That might be the Job level that Croker's talking about. That America creates new technologies that consume itself, and it tolerates it, like Job.
Insofar as McLuhan had his eyes firmly fixed, or at least in the early days on America, yeah, I guess then that would come through.
I'm not sure what you're saying there. What would come through?
If America is Job and McLuhan is the observer and mime of America, at least in the early period, then he would take on those characteristics of Job-ness.
Right. So Pound should have capitalized the J in Job.
Yeah, we can end it there. I don't know whether that's any good, but
Well, you don't know whether what's any good. What I just said?
No, whether the insight on Job actually gives us anything or not. But
You'd have to get the Croker book out and read what he says, and then play off that. But we don't have that right here. So Andrew says, after quoting the Pound letter to McLuhan, he says one can see why he eventually had to flee the United States. Now, I would take that. Yes, he couldn't. He was a Luddite. He had to retreat from the technological abundance that was going to start pouring out by the mid-50s in the United States. I don't know if that's what Andrew means, but that's why I would see he had to flee. Now, but Lewis sees something like that happening in his book American Cosmic Man in 1948. See, Lewis sees what's happening in America better than Pound.
Yeah, okay.
Look at that. And look at Pound. Look at Lewis. He sees the new man coming out of America.
Yeah, American Cosmic Man, yep.
Yeah, and Pound only sees crooks. I mean, Lewis says that the European cannot see the landscapes of, it's too provincial, can't see the landscapes of the huge new American environments. And McLuhan repeats that point. He says the Europeans in their little city states and city environments, you know, ancient city environments cannot see the vast spaces of the super angelization of humans.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say that. I guess I always want to find something valid in Pound. I mean, Pound does have a point. I mean, all American politicians, in a sense, are crooks, in some sort of way, and so he is seeing something valid about. The hustling nature of American commerce and culture.
Well, but what he doesn't notice is that politicians have to be crooks because their sole rearview mirror, the environment they represent of cash and the private legal control of cash, you know, through the Federal Reserve, is not actually how cash is created. It's such an obsolete function to be a politician, that visual space structure in the global theater, that they preserve private identity and prop up the fact of some kind of human scale for the American citizen to project into, but you can be nothing but crooks. And McLuhan says in an interview in the 70s, I remember, he says, all politicians are crooks, he says, by necessity. He's not upset about it. He understands their dilemma.
Yeah.
Blowing both horns of their dilemma.
Also,
they're forced.
The crook is the flip of the artist as well, in McLuhan's framework, you know, that he's...
And that's the very issue that Don Thiel gets into trouble with McLuhan over his first book, The Medium is a Rearview Mirror, where he's talking about McLuhan celebrating the con man, and McLuhan objects to that on a certain level. You remember that argument, that point?
Yeah. But all through McLuhan's correspondence, he's talking about that book, The Big Con. He loved those books.
Yeah, because he understood that The Big Con is all that business can do, because they represent... another line he said is, it's no longer this inscrutable East, it's the inscrutable West. Is that no one understands the problem in America, which is creating all this technological abundance and implosion, how their own culture is totally inadequately prepared for the effects and must maintain the ruse of visual space, the Trump allele of visual space, and the poor politician is the sacrificial lamb in that. And a great movie about that is called Secret Honor. See it sometime. Came out in the mid-'80s where a friend of Mae Brussels, I forget his name, Don somebody, wrote a play that was done in theater showing Nixon after Watergate talking about how he was just a janitor for, you know, slang complaints. He was the dog catcher. He was complaining about the obsolete role of being the president without the McLuhan understanding, but doing the figure slang and grievance and funny human predicaments that came, that the contradictions of the ground created. It's a good movie. Recommend it. Secret Honor.
Yeah, no, I will. It's kind of odd that none of the serious McLuhanites, Bob, who've made a career from critiquing McLuhan, have ever really gone and talking about McLuhan's influences in terms of David Mora and the Big Con. And
David who?
It's David Mora. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. M-A-U-R-E-R. Maura. David Maura.
And he wrote the book, The Big Con?
Yeah.
No.
The story of the confidence man.
Well, like the official McLuhans don't talk about anything relevant in McLuhan. I'm the only one who does even notice what McLuhan's doing. You get a huge education listening to these things about what McLuhan talked about. De Kirchhoff, Eric Logan, Levinson, Strait, Bruce Powell. Now, Bruce Powell in his talk got into it a bit. He brought in the what I've said for 25 years in radio, that Canada is the Switzerland of the solar government. Switzerland being, you know, the place where you can launder money or keep your secret dirty accounts and all that.
Yeah.
He points that out, that Canada is the funding place for terrorists in exchange for not being bombed. It's a very good kind of Dobbsian insight he puts in there, but those are dime or dozen and more that we can say that McLuhan already dealt with. Okay, so yeah, what were you saying about the official McLuhanites, that they don't what? I already said it, but I want to hear your version.
Yeah, where's the discussion of,
the Big Con.
Yeah, the Big Con and those other influences.
Do you know, it first starts talking about the Big Con, and I think a letter to the editor of one of the Toronto papers in about 1971, where he says, I have an insight and a eureka. The Big Con was the developers lay up like a high price for something, and they know that the public discussion of it will whittle it down, and therefore the con man looks like that he's given in, but he's already planning to operate at the level it's whittled down, so he makes an outrageous bid and gets it on a high level. I think that's what McLuhan talks about. Does that sound familiar?
No, that doesn't come to mind, but... That would be there's McLuhan, the economist, and talking about the new economics.
Yeah, well, like I say in my essay, Holopathy Quadrophenia, McLuhan was a physicist, a sociologist, a priest, a scientist, an economist, an artist, a musician, a drummer. he was HCE. He was acting out what Finnegan's Wake was showing.
Yeah,
HCE could do everything.
Yeah, I like drummer. Drummer's nice, I guess. What is it? Beat and timing, you know, the essence of the language of tactility.
Yeah, and you have Zappa says that in 1969-70 in a New York Times interview, in our group, we don't know who the drummer is. That's tactile. I was talking tactility, all tactile. Because McLuhan had the guitar playing percussively and the sax, you know what I mean? And he began as a teenager as a drummer, but he switched to guitar. But that's a great statement. In our group, we don't know who the drummer is. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, I rate that. Hey, Bob, let's keep moving. Otherwise, we'll just fixate and we'll end up on December forever. So let's go and read a few of the January posts.
Okay, I just want to finish. So he says, one can see why Pound eventually had to flee the United States. A browse through the published letters Marshall wrote to Ezra Pound shows they spoke on a variety of subjects, cites the letters of McLuhan book. Marshall also wrote to Mrs. Pound, and his letters to Ezra begin with, Dear Pound, and end with, Cordially yours. So Marshall held him in esteem, though I'm not sure the same is true for Pound. So we've gone through the complexities and subtleties of that. I hope Andrew learned and appreciates what we've provided as fulfilling out what he's intuiting there. The letters in the book are now located at the National Archives, where you will have to travel to see the letters from the people he corresponds with. I think the book would have been more interesting if it showed some of the letters Marshall received from the people he wrote to. Yep. Which is not to say that there's anything wrong with letters of McLuhan, the book. As I ring in the new year in Picton, that's in Ontario, I will take a few moments to think of the man I can't remember, but am proud and honored to be getting to know. Rest in peace. So now he does the rest in peace thing in kind of half English, right? Herbert Marshall McLuhan, July 20th. Oh, he didn't correct that one. You got to correct the second date here, July 20th, 1911, to December 31st, 1980. Okay, so that's, what was that, December?
Yep.
So on to
January.
January 9th. It's called Urban Congestion as Psychedelic Anesthesia. Now, I assume that's a direct quote from McLuhan, right?
I'm not sure.
I think it is, but we'll see. January 4th, 2011. You know, it was around January 4th that McLuhan's funeral was held in 1981, first week of January. You can check that out. So this would be the 30th anniversary of McLuhan's funeral at, I think it's called Trinity Church. Is it Trinity Church? I think so. On St. Clair Avenue. So, January 4th, 2011. Happy New Year. It's belatedly looking a lot like Christmas. A lot of snow has fallen today, making the drive out here from Picton this morning slow and interesting. Eric's only come in this afternoon. He's not been feeling well. His health has always been fragile. At a very young age, he was confined to his bed for quite a long time. And over the years, he has had serious health problems, mostly as a consequence of diabetes. One time, many years ago now, he was hospitalized, and it's amazing that he pulled through. I will never forget being at his hospital bedside while a priest read his last rites. I think the priest almost read the last rites several times for Marshall. Not sure, but Marshall was always in trouble on the health level many times. Last year, while traveling, well, apparently he was. You know what I mean? Who knows what Marshall... Oh, talking with Scott Taylor, he doesn't like the Douglas Copeland book. And I said to him, yeah, Generation X, they're actually an autistic generation, as Scott Taylor lays it out. And so you have Douglas Copeland projecting his generational bias on McLuhan, saying that McLuhan was autistic. That's how they're claiming McLuhan for their generation. He's like us. He's autistic.
Yeah, well, I guess in... I'm difficult to talk about Copeland's book. I quite enjoyed some of his work, but that.
You mean you enjoyed other books or you enjoyed parts of the biography?
No, I've enjoyed parts of his other books, but that biography was fairly unthrilling to me.
Okay, I can't bring myself to read it. So I have to remain on the margins on that debate. Okay, last year. I'll create a distraction on the sidelines by releasing my own autobiography. Okay. Last year, Andrew says, while traveling with Eric in Poland, he had a close call one morning in Krakow. I think that's Krakow, right? Krakow. He came to find me having a morning cigarette outside the hotel to tell me he'd taken the wrong insulin. Disaster was narrowly averted thanks to the hotel restaurant's ready supply of orange juice fortified with sugar packets and our guide, Father Jacek. He's the father who did the medium and the light, right?
Yes.
And our guide, Father Jacek, who helped me get him through the hospital after to make sure. When was this? Disaster was narrowly averted thanks to the hotel restaurant supply, blah, 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 and our guide who helped to get him through the hospital after to make sure. Is that right? Grammatically? To make sure? What did they make sure of?
Well, presumably that they'd saved his life or they'd done the right thing or that he wasn't going to...
The hotel restaurants met ready supply and our guide who helped him get through the hospital after... Oh, just... They don't... He shouldn't have the comma after. To make sure. Hospital after. But maybe it's correct to have the comma. Okay, just to make sure. The preceding words are to illustrate yet more reasons I feel lucky to be able to work here in the scriptorium with my father. Today I finished cataloging Marshall's Pound collection and am moving on to T.S. Eliot. The Kennedy book, Crowds and Power, shown here, is a good example of the kind of thing I am lucky enough to see every day. Inside the cover where he signs his name, Marshall writes, quote, urban congestion as psychedelic anesthesia, unquote. Oftentimes, Marshall's notations are just page references or grabbed quotes. On occasion, though, you find a little gem like this. In Cliché d'Archétype, McLuhan says that yokels find going to the city a psychedelic experience. You remember that line in Cliché d'Archétype?
No, but yeah, it makes sense.
So I would relate that to, he's explaining why the yokels find the city a psychedelic experience because of urban congestion and its psychedelic anesthesia. He's pointing out that psychedelics is a band-aid. In the mid-60s, psychedelics was the greatest art form for that period dealing with the global theater. But 5 years later, I'm assuming, who knows when, yeah, let's say a few years later, he makes a disparaging remark on LSD as a chemical warfare in Counterblast 1969. So it's become anesthetic because something else can be the anesthetic, or something else, excuse me, could be the non-anesthetic. What would that be in the world of ersatz and environments? So urban congestion is psychedelic. So if you want to have a psychedelic experience, which is an anesthetic, not able to take the global information overload and stimulation, you go to the city to get local small scale congestion and psychedelic overload. Hey, any points on that? Crowds and power. So
congestion. I'm just unraveling that, Bob. Just many layers. I mean, McLuhan used to talk about, I think, supermarkets as as symbolist constructs and that sort of thing. And he occasionally talks about supermarkets. But I was really fixated on this book, Kennedy's book, Crowds and Power. I know this is something that Eric quirks up quite a lot, and I think his electric language is very much in reference to, I mean, it's an electric crowds and power in many ways. But
okay, you got another sentence? I got to say something before I forget it. You want to say, okay, electric landscape, and go ahead.
No, please. Okay. I'm just all trying right to put pieces together.
When you say that he wrote probably in his earlier years that supermarkets were symbolist structures?
Construct structures.
That's exactly he's doing the Lewisian program or the American program of taking arty, word poetry, the word world, the verbal world, the literary world, and translating it into technological environments. That's the very point.
Yeah.
He takes practical criticism, and I guess the Europeans just study verbal texts, and he applies, as an American, practical criticism, not what the British would do, but to the technological environments. Now, Leibniz's book, Something in Environment, 1933, it's an influential book on McLuhan. He could say the British are halfway between the American and the European, but they don't go as far as McLuhan, seeing symbolist structures in the supermarket. But that's exactly McLuhan's method of translating verbal insights, verbal avant-garde gestures, and seeing them in the technological landscape.
Yeah, I guess Pound would have been horrified by that, in the classroom, McLuhan saying, well, just treat these great Western cannons like as if you're walking around a supermarket. Pick up these packets of chips and give them a shake and, rip them open, touch the poetry, but essentially it's just a supermarket.
Right, and so I would take that sentence that Andrew writes in the previous entry, how Pound, you can see why he had to flee the United States. With that kind of insight about McLuhan and Pound, you can see why McLuhan had to flee Pound.
Yeah.
Right? Because Pound wouldn't have tolerated that stuff. Okay. So the other thing, crowds and power. You notice in Eric's talk in Bologna, he lays out the structure of influences, so to speak, on McLuhan. He has Jacques Ellul and Culture's Propaganda, and he also names Kennedy. And he names a few other guys, what the usual suspects, Lewis or something. You remember who he cited? They were the repertoire or ammunition that McLuhan always used in all his books. Gombrich, matching and making from Gombrich, crowd dynamics from Kennedy, And what was the other one I just said? A propagandist culture from Elul. He would always quote those guys.
Yep.
And there's a couple others. So so when Eric emphasizes Kennedy, that's okay, but McClellan goes a lot further than Kennedy. I don't know. He sees Kennedy as studying crowds because that's the electric effect. Kennedy is a dupe of the electric environment. He starts seeing mass man and trying to make sense out of the figure of mass man and misses the ground. See, that's the point. McLuhan is taking Elul and Kennedy and who else did I say? Whoever else I said. Those guys that Eric cites, they're all knee-jerk reflexes. They're figures for Marshall's own supermarket symbolist structure. So what is, you know what McLuhan's making? Not a supermarket, but a space capsule. See, what machine is McLuhan making? What is his large glass?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think the large glass is a great image. Transparency, see-through, that's light through, right? With cartoony stick figures, and cartoons as the content of the Mad Vestibule to TV. What would be the machine that McLuhan is making? Is it the satellite? Is it the air traffic controller? Which machine is McLuhan? If you today, I would teach. You know, I go to Bruce Powell's Fry and McLuhan class and say, "See McLuhan's writings in what?"
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
It's like the search engine in that sense. You know, you just type in symbolist, and it just pops up supermarket, crowds and power, something else as a big list.
Well, that's spinning its wake. So since he was translating, he was turning Finning. What was the machine that Finning's wake represented? That's the machine that Marshall was walking around with, and it's basically the internet. And what's interesting, when the internet showed up, the populace, or Wired, or the average cognoscenti, saw McLuhan was writing about that. It finally, the environment that he was describing showed up. That's why he was made the saint for Wired. And that's really what he was. And, you know, of course, he was the one who described that environment in interviews in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
So,
on that same point, so if we can stick with that, that's just as a, I was going to say as a point of digression, but not. Okay, here you got Pound, going back to Pound. Pound was there as a young kid when the symbolists were cool, in a sense. And now you've got him in 50s America where a symbolist structure is being used in every facet of life.
Yeah,
what
in advertising?
Just everywhere. Like it's everything that he has seen that was cool has become totally vulgarized. Everything, like he's almost in a sense complicit in creating this entire world.
Right. Here's a side thing. Remember how McLuhan said the Bauhaus program of the 20s was now environmental in 50s,
yeah,
with 60s
the
America.
What does that do to an artist who's done that and who sees the world reflected back at them in that sort of way?
Well, that's an update of him saying the pound and the bomb in 45 upsets the artistic ego. Yeah, the mixed corporate media environments of the 50s, 60s threaten all these guys again. And, you know, one artist who kind of recognized that and gave up was Salvador Dali. He didn't mind just working and becoming a guy designing ads. You know what I mean? He gave up his ego.
Yeah.
Which a lot of, and then there's a lot of, you know, different interpretation. And so he almost, you know, mirrored back that the his enemies were big egos by trying to put on a bigger ego than them with his megalomania. So it just occurs to me how Salvador Dali, and, you know, Dali was someone that McLuhan didn't knock. But he was very unpopular in the 1670s as a guy who didn't get as far among the hip New York art cognoscenti as Duchamp. But anyways, you know, McLuhan writes in Interior Landscape that Pound and them should have given up in 1922, stopped being POBs.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is, so can we say that software communism with an individualist editing capability, which is the internet, Web 2.0, is the machine that is the translation of McLuhan structures?
I'd have to meditate on that for some time, Bob.
Yeah. I mean, this I call it in my essays 10 years ago, satellite conductors. I saw McLuhan, Zappa, Thompson, Crooker, satellite conductors. Definitely Tetrad managers is half the deal. But maybe the internet is some the Android meme. All right. McLuhan, in his analog media phase, his machine was the air traffic controller or the guy at NASA, which, you know, the big moon landing happens around his birthday, so you can stick McLuhan in there. So the organizers of NASA and the Spain, McLuhan, in have you ever seen that interview in Forces? I think you saw it, 1973. He said the most interesting part of the moon landings was not covered by NASA. The broadcast should have been describing how the instruments kept controlling the environment in the satellite so that the technology there didn't eat or consume the astronauts alive. So they had to keep the liquid in their spacesuits a certain way. You remember that kind of talk? The modulating. So McLuhan said a better coverage of the moon landing would be people, you know, Howard Cosell, oh, look, the oxygen content's going down 3.4 liters. We're going to have to get some more liters put in. You know what I mean? That describing of the environment that the body was in.
Yeah, it was a pornography of statistics, which would have been that same sort of space that baseball has, I guess, in American culture.
Yeah, well, that's the old thing. But look at this. This is actually pretty good. Never been said before. The way McLuhan described how they made sure the space capsule was a safe environment was exactly what McLuhan was saying he'd do in the 60s globally. He'd be in a position with the computer to monitor the effects of new media and all the cultures around the world, and then say a little more literacy here, a little more of that, radio there, on a micro scale. Doing it on one astronaut with the garb he had on, the hyper-technical garb, was a miniature version of him, McLuhan, doing it collectively. So NASA is the technological translation of McLuhan's structures, McLuhan's patterns. So then the Android meme replays that with the internet. They replay McLuhan. So the Android meme celebrates McLuhan in the 90s. You know what I mean? Because they're making spaceships. The internet makes everybody a spaceship inhabitant, right? With their little computer console flying all over the galaxies.
Yep.
So that's pretty good and a nice pattern. You like that one, Jim? I think Jim would like that one.
Yeah, well, so McLuhan's NASA of inner space would have been interesting enterprise to try and set up.
Not inner space. Of all the spaces. And their simulations is what he Tetrad managed. See, the whole Tetrad is, uh-oh, something's being enhanced. It's obsolescing the tube that goes into the heart, and it's retrieving the tube around the leg, and, uh-oh, it's going to flip into too much in the ear.
Nice.
You like that? That's the Tetradic process right there. Okay, so... So urban congestion is psychedelic anesthesia. When you understand McLuhan's structures, it's obvious he would write something like that. It's not hard. See, McLuhan is not hard to understand once you get it. I don't think it's hard to get it. But it takes a little – if you have a good teacher.
the good teachers are hard to come by, Bob.
Yeah.
They're at a premium these days.
Oftentimes, McLuhan's – okay, we did that. On occasion, though, you'll find a little gem like this. So we've done that one. That's about crowds and power. You know, it's techno crowds and power is what the Tetrad manager at NASA does. You know, it's chemical congestion in the body of the astronaut, which is psychedelic anesthesia.
Yep.
Okay, so the next one, mechanisms for shaping sensibility. January 10th, so 6 days later, Andrew's busy, he makes another report. January 10th, you want to read it, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm just trying to find where we are. So we're mechanisms for shaping sensibility, is this the one?
Yeah, yeah, January 12th. He has January 12th for the main date, but he has January 10th underneath it. Maybe he means he wrote January 10th and posted it on January 12th.
We're flipping into Lewis, the Lewis quadrant now.
Yep, excellent.
January 10. I'm excited to be able to share this with you, dear reader. I came upon this flexi-disc included in a magazine, Arts Canada, number 114, November 1967. The items were in their original clear plastic case, which I slit open. Over 40 years after it was sealed, I couldn't resist. The magazine.
Now, I want to tell you, I have a copy of this magazine, and I bought it back in 67 when it came out. I got it. That would be the fall of 67. Yep, that's where I bought it.
Yep, I have two, courtesy of Michael Edmonds. It was a great gift, for which I'm quite grateful.
That's right. I lost mine many years ago, and Michael got me one too, which I appreciate.
So I couldn't resist. The magazine features an article on electromedia movement and includes a separate several-page color edition of, in brackets, former student of Marshall McLuhan of U of T's, Sheila Watson's essay, The Great War, Wyndham Lewis and the Underground Press. And it is a great essay. As well as many war-era drawings of Lewis's and a couple portraits. In brackets, Lewis' portrait of Marshall is dear to me.
Yeah, now, the Underground Press is like the fad. In 66, 67, 68, the Underground Press was a new phenomenon, and Walter Boer was a major figure with the East Village out of New York. And so the art gang in Toronto were commenting on the latest fad. I think Toronto had an underground newspaper. Montreal did. I think it was called Oz, but I'm not sure about Toronto. Toronto had one. There was the Georgia Strait out in Vancouver, but let's assume there was some kind of mimeograph stuff happening. But the Underground Press was the hip-hop of its day. What would be a fad today? Texting. Sex testing. So, the Great War, Wyndham Lewis and sex testing. You know, sex texting. This is what we're talking about. The Underground Press is the popular culture of that period, of that year. 67.
Yeah.
And so they're going to say, oh, Wyndham Lewis did that. You know, his blast was the Underground Press of his day. Which is true. Okay, carry on.
Just as a little digression. Oh, no, we can go back to that later. The Flexidus is two things. An interview with Marshall and Lewis reading excerpts from his book of poetry, One Way Song. I edited my little transcript a little to cut out some of the ums and ahs. Here's Marshall McLuhan recalling his experience in recording Lewis reading.
Okay, you're not being precise enough.
It's in print. People can read this thing, Bob. People could read along at the same time.
Oh, they won't have time to read it. They're only going to listen to this once, and we got to give it to them exactly at the moment. So I just want to qualify this. So this is the first time that what McLuhan says on the little record that they provide with the magazine, first time it's been transcribed, right?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
Yeah. So, quote, he seems to be quoting the host of the interview. He's saying, here's Marsh McLuhan recalling his experience in recording Lewis reading. All right, so I think I'll read this, okay?
Go for it.
In St. Louis, says, this is what McLuhan is saying, right? Yeah, this is McLuhan talking. In St. Louis, look at that. St. Louis, Lewis came down. And, you know, he marries Corinne Lewis. Isn't it Corinne Lewis? Right? Isn't his wife's name Lewis? I think it is. So you got Wyndham Lewis, Corinne Lewis in St. Louis.
Yep.
In St. Louis, Wyndham Lewis came down to visit and to do some paintings. In brackets, Marshall had arranged several portrait commissions for Lewis in St. Louis, where Marshall was teaching. So who's saying all that? I guess this is Andrew saying this? Okay, yeah. So Andrew's saying...
See, and you accuse me of being imprecise, Bob. Come on.
No, but at least I'm being precise. You would have just slurred over this and left out the brackets. But I'll make this better. Just let's figure it out. I haven't read this for a few weeks. I don't know exactly how Marshall Wyndham became acquainted, but I will try and get the story from Erica related to you in a future post. Well, we'll tell them how they got acquainted. Marshall's mother was aware of Stan Murphy, father of Murphy's program at Windsor, what was it called, Assumption University back in the 40s.
Uh-huh.
And she noted that Wyndham Lewis was speaking at the university and called or wrote Marshall, and he took his friend Felix, forget it.
Giovanelli?
Yeah, he took Felix and his St. Louis University professor buddy. They ran and got the next train up to Windsor. Just like if I heard Zappa was playing New York, I'd be getting the next plane, man. I knew where the stuff was happening. He knew this was big. So he runs up to Windsor thanks to his mother. Or maybe the lecture might have been Detroit-Windsor area. One would think it was probably Windsor, but I think Marshall in the story says Detroit. But what the heck? They're right beside each other. So starting this over again, Andrew writes, in St. Louis, Lewis came down to visit and to do some paintings, and I managed to persuade Lewis to read something from One Way Song for our little home recorder. And there weren't many tape recorders around. This would be 1943. Okay? There wasn't I know that McLuhan is on the grass in 1943, and you know, in the summer lawn, talking to Lewis. So this is 43. He's just finished his thesis. See, here's the interesting thing: he's just finished his thesis. What do we do next? And then the whole hidden ground of his thesis shows up, right, in person.
Yep.
And so McLuhan's saying, invite him down to some paintings. I managed to convince him to do a poem, One Way Song. And it was most interesting to observe Lewis upon hearing his own voice. He simply, once he heard the recording, Lewis simply roared with laughter. In all the years preceding it, it never occurred to him that he had essentially an English voice.